it's pretty well agreed that we're now living in an economic crisis. It's also pretty well agreed that most economists, especially so-called establishment economists, don't know what to do about it. This is pretty unusual, considering that up until about 5 years ago, the ruling economic establishment not only believed but also trumpeted far and wide that they knew exactly what to do about all economic problems. Everything had been solved. As a matter of fact, I think about 5 years ago, the distinguished Keynesian economist Robert Solow of MIT wrote that something to the effect that macroeconomic problems, macroeconomic meaning things like business cycles, inflation, recession, depression, and so forth, that all macroeconomic problems have now been solved, and everything is, all economic macroeconomic theory has been taken care of. Now, usually when somebody says that, that's the sort of the beginning of the deluge. Sure enough, only a few years later, the same economists have virtually thrown up their hands and say, we don't know what's going on. We really don't know what to do. This does not mean, of course, that they've resigned their jobs in Washington, by the way. Which leads me to my favorite story. Anybody who's heard this, I apologize for repeating it. About, I think, in the recession of 1958, which was the first recession where the phenomenon of the inflationary recession first began to appear. This was the first time when prices were still rising during the recession. And here we had an authentic, officially authenticated and certified recession, and yet prices, instead of falling, which is what prices are supposed to be doing in a recession, instead of falling, prices were still going up. They weren't going up very much, but they were going up. Arthur Burns, who at that time had just resigned as head of the Council of Economic Advisers in the Eisenhower administration, was giving a lecture up at Fordham, which I happened to attend, giving the usual Keynesian policies, which I'll go into a little bit later, what to do about recessions. Basically, when there's a recession, you pump spending into the system. The government pumps spending into the system, thereby lifting the economy upward. And when there's an inflation, the government takes money out or takes spending out of the system. You work several variants or changes on this theme, and that's essentially the Keynesian or the establishment program. And so Burns was going into explaining this policy, and during the question period, I was a brash young fellow at that time. I said, well, Professor Burns, what do you do if the policy, what the government's supposed to be doing is pump in deficits during a recession and take out spending or have higher taxes or surplus during a boom, what do you do if both are happening at the same time, as it seems to be happening right now? In other words, what do you do if there's an inflation and a recession at the same time? Well, he said, his first reply was, well, there's no problem there because the recession will soon be over and so forth. And I said, well, okay, and it was soon over in 58. But I said, what happens, Professor Burns, if at some future date the same phenomena will recur and intensify? We'll have a severe recession along with an accelerating inflation. What then would you recommend? And he stopped for a moment. He said, well, in that case, we'd all have to resign. Well, they haven't resigned. The rest, of course, is history. The phenomenon has arrived and is with us right now, and nobody's resigned. It's one of Rothbard's laws of political science that nobody ever resigns from government unless your hand is caught directly in the till. The Nobel Prize to Professor Hayek is very interesting because it comes in this context. It comes in a context where establishment economics doesn't know what's going on and really admit it. The unusual part of the Nobel Prize is that all the other Nobel Prizes, which have been awarded by the Swedish Academy, have gone to people who are completely, economists who are completely in the opposite camp as Professor Hayek. In other words, economists who are mathematical forecasters and also left liberals, if you can use that term, who believe in government planning of the economy. And for the first time, the Hayek Award goes directly and completely contrary to this tradition of the Nobel Award, which surprised all of us enormously. Perhaps a clue to why the Nobel Committee did this, presumably they were hedging their bets, was that in the award they said, quote, they hailed Professor Hayek, quote, his pioneering work in the theory of money and economic fluctuations. Well, they didn't say what this pioneering work was. What I'd like to do tonight is to go into this and try to explain why I think not only that was Professor Hayek's work pioneering, but is also the only correct analysis of business cycles, past, present, and future. The whole phenomenon of the business cycle really began in approximately the mid-18th century. Before that, there was no real business cycle. I mean, business would be going along at a certain sort of an even pace, and then something would happen. Usually the government would mess things up, of course they are accustomed to do. the king would confiscate all, he would decide to raise money fast by confiscating all the gold of the merchants. And this, of course, would cause a severe depression. But it wasn't a business cycle sort of thing. It wasn't any kind of mysterious boom-bust phenomenon. It was simply that the king suddenly confiscated everybody's money and depression set in. So that was the sort of thing that would happen until about the mid-18th century, when we began to have this peculiar phenomenon of boom-bust cycles, which appear not periodically, but recurrently. In other words, the phenomenon of inflation and prosperity and so forth, rising prices usually, followed by a bank collapse and depression and unemployment, and then followed again by a recovery and then a boom and so forth. And this was kind of a puzzling phenomenon because it didn't fit into the general economic theory. And so shortly after the phenomenon appeared, economists began to try to explain what was going on here. Why was there this recurring phenomenon not directly, well, clearly related to the king confiscating somebody's money? In other words, something else seemed to be going on here. Couldn't clearly pinpoint the cause. Well, as time went on, two groups of theories began to develop. Of course, there are a lot of different kinds of theories, but essentially they could be classified into two groups. One group, which has been dominant generally, and certainly dominant up until the Austrian school revival. Generally, the dominant school held that the root cause must be, since around the middle of the 18th century, at about the time business cycles first developed, the boom-bust cycle, at about that time also came the Industrial Revolution. Industrialization and the modern capitalist economy first comes in, really, at that point. So therefore, these various economists concluded that the cause of the business cycle must somehow lie deeply rooted within the free market industrial capitalist system. In other words, the blame, because usually it's considered blameworthy, a boom-bust cycle, the blame rests with free market capitalism. Karl Marx was one of the first economists to propound this theory, and John Maynard Keynes, in his famous work in 1936, not only also has a similar view, establishing Keynesian orthodoxy, but also said very explicitly that before him, before Keynes wrote, that classical or free market economists had no theory of the business cycle. They had no explanation for the business cycle or for unemployment or depression. They hadn't thought about it. They hadn't really given their attention to it. He was the first one to really do it. And he therefore understood that depression was caused by some virus of underspending in the private market economy, which was supposed to be made up by government spending. In other words, if the cause of depression, say, is the efficiency of spending, obviously the government is the deus ex machina, the god out of the machine, but the government can magically come out of the system and spend more. Obviously, because you can print money, he didn't quite say that, but that's clearly the implication. If you can print money, you're in good position to engage in deficit spending. The cure, then, let me put it this way. The Keynesian vision of the economy was, which has been dominant up until the present, so this is not just an antiquarian kind of exercise. The picture was essentially this. While a free market economy can do very well when it handles so-called microeconomic problems, it can clear the market, it can solve the problem of how much wheat to produce or how much brandy or whatever, and it can set the prices and production in these various areas. In the microeconomy, the free market works very well. However, in the macro and so-called macroeconomy, the free market doesn't work. The theory being the free market can't provide the proper amount of total spending. And so the Keynesian picture of the economy is essentially one where a free market economy is essentially one where the economy is like an automobile, and you're driving down a very narrow sort of tightrope or ledge with two abysses on either side. One is the abyss of unemployment, which occurs if there's too little spending. The other is the abyss of inflation, which occurs if there's too much spending. And the task of the government is sort of the pop-up driver of the car. Obviously, if you have the economy is a car, you have to have somebody driving it. So the task of Big Brother government is to be at the steering wheel, fine-tuning the economy in such a way as to keep total spending perfectly and precisely attuned to the so-called full employment line, which is that the economy doesn't fall off on the one hand to the abyss of depression and the other hand to the abyss of inflation. So the task of government is to keep the economy on this line. The Keynesians came to the conclusion very early that they had the proper tools of doing this. They could pump spending in, as I said before, in case there's too little spending. They can push the steering wheel to the right, so to speak. They can take spending out if there's an inflation. This was essentially the what we can call the established Keynesian orthodoxy of what the government's supposed to be doing and what causes recession. But this has clearly not worked, as is pretty evident by this time, even to Keynesians, who were desperately flailing around to try to find some other explanation of why they have to go back to the old drawing board. Because obviously what's happening now is that there's accelerated inflation, at the same time there's a recession, and there's recurring recession, which we're going through right now. And as Arthur Burns said, we all have to resign, except nobody does it. Okay, that's one school of thought, one general area of thought, which locates the cause of the business cycle or the cause of depression or the cause of inflation somewhere within the market economy, somewhere within the industrial capitalist system. There is, however, another group of economists, another tradition of economics, which has been neglected until very recently, which says something very different. Actually, this was the view of Ricardo and the classical economists in the 19th century. In a sort of rudimentary form. Essentially what the second group says is that something else happened in the middle of the 18th century, not just the Industrial Revolution, but another institution which is directly the cause of the business cycle, and that is the banking system, or more precisely the fractional reserve banking system. And even more precisely than that, this is the government involvement with the banking system through the central banks. The sort of the first simpler model of this, the so-called monetary view of the business cycle, came about with Ricardo and the classical economists. Essentially, they had a very simple kind of view, but it was pretty good, considering it was in the 19th century economics. Basically, what they said was that the government and the banking system, government promotes bank credit expansion of federal fractional reserve banking. Money and credit, the supply of money and credit go up. This raises prices, creates a prosperity, or phony prosperity, or real prosperity, whatever variant they took on that. This causes the inflationary boom part of the cycle. And then what happens is that the gold of banks in the country begin to lose gold to other countries, because as domestic prices go up and foreign prices still remain the same, gold drains out to other countries. Until finally the pressure gets very intense on the banks, finally the gold drains out and their bank credit has increased. And so the reserve ratio keeps dwindling, and finally they've got to stop expanding and contract in order to save themselves. And this contraction causes the recession part of the business cycle. And during the recession, prices, money supply falls, prices fall, and gold flows back in to the country and get a recovery. And then after this happens, the banks are ready to start in again, start expanding again. Well, this is a fairly simple model of a business cycle, but it's pretty accurate as far as it goes. It pinpoints, in my view, the basic cause of the business cycle is not embedded deep within the industrial capitalist free market economy, but within the banking system and the government-controlled banking system. Why is the government and the banking system always desirous of increasing the money supply? Well, it's fairly simple. Any group which seizes control of the money supply, in other words, any group which has the only legalized... Well, let me put it this way. The government and its controlled banking system is the only institution in society which has the right to counterfeit, in other words, the right to increase the supply of money. If any of the rest of us start counterfeiting, printing dollars, not only would we go to jail, we'd go to jail very, very swiftly and for a very long period of time. Counterfeiter is always one of the most reviled criminals on the government books, because a private mugger get off with a slap and a suspended sentence, perhaps, because he's only mugging individual citizens. But the counterfeiter strikes at the root of the government's monopoly of the creation of money, which is much more important for the government than the mugger. So one of the first things that the government does early in the game is to seize control, in other words, acquire a compulsory monopoly of the right to print money. And my contention is, if you have the right to print money, you're going to use it, like anything else, because you can print money, you can spend it, or you can print money and you can lend it out to favored groups, politically favored groups. So the natural tendency of government and its controlled banking system is to inflate. There's no mystery about it. This is what they always want to do anyway. There are certain checks on the process, such as the fact of losing gold, well, we are on the gold standard, losing gold abroad, which runs on the banks before the FDIC came in 1933 to stop that. But in the natural course of events, there are basic market checks on this phenomenon, which keep the process at least a little bit in hand. We've managed to eliminate most of those checks at this point, by the way. So here we have sort of the basic model, which places, I say, the blame for the business cycle in the banking system and the the government-controlled banking system, the inflationary process of money creation. This, however, wasn't really a totally satisfactory theory of the business cycle. It left out a lot of stuff, for one thing. It left out the problem, why is it, for example, that there's always a greater boom and bust in the capital goods industries, the machine tools and industrial raw materials and construction? Why is it there always a much greater business cycle in that area than there is in consumer goods? Why is there a sudden collapse of business forecasting? Businessmen, after all, are sort of expert forecasters. They usually know what's going to happen fairly well. How come they all suddenly collapse at the crisis point when the recession or depression arrives? And so these various deficiencies meant there were certain gaps in the theory which had to be fleshed out. Well, what happened was that Ludwig von Mises, the founder of the modern Austrian school, began the so-called Austrian theory of business cycle in 1912 when he published his theory of money and credit. What he did was he built on the Ricardian foundation and the classical foundation, also added the insights of the Swedish economist Knut Wicksell on the key difference between the free market interest rate, or so-called natural interest rate, and the loan rate of banks, and what integrated this whole thing into a theory which, as far as I'm concerned, is the only theory which is integrated completely with regular economics, with micro, so-called microeconomics. Mises simply outlined this very briefly in 1912, and it was left to Friedrich Hayek in the late 1920s to spin the whole thing out in two beautiful books, which I still recommend as the best books on the topic, still in print, I believe, Prices and Production and the Monetary Theory of the Trade Cycle. The Monetary Theory of the Trade Cycle sort of introduces this whole subject, sets the thing in perspective, and the Prices and Production is more technical. Both of these were written in the late 20s. Well, what Mises and Hayek did in the late 20s, and the thing which really struck the rest of the economic world of economists, was that they more or less predicted the Great Depression. In other words, here you are in 1927 or 28, the whole world of establishment economics said there's going to be permanent prosperity. There ain't going to be no depressions, no more, no more. And everybody said this. We were living in what the Coolidge Hoover administration has called the new era. And the reason was that we had created this wonderful engine called the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve System was to keep everything at an even keel. There was sort of like a pre-Keynesian theory. The idea was that if prices fell, the Federal Reserve would pump money in. If prices rose, the Federal Reserve would take money out. As a result, there couldn't be any depression. Meantime, while this euphoria was being engaged in among establishment economists, Mises and Hayek in Austria were saying, no, there's going to be a depression because what? Well, for one thing, they too, along with the classical economists, said that the cause of the business cycle was not an industry or the market economy or industrialization, but the banking system. And the problem was not so much in the price level, not so much the fact that prices went up and the money was pumped in, but that when inflationary credit expansion was pumped into the system, it not only tended to raise prices, it did something even worse than that, in a sense. It tended to distort the production system. In other words, it tended to cause an overinvestment in things like construction and capital goods and industrial raw materials, an underinvestment in consumer goods. And that the longer this happened, this part of this was wrapped up in the fact that interest rates were pushed down artificially by the expanded bank credit. And the longer this process continued, the longer the government kept pushing this, the more severe the recession would have to be. The idea being this, and this is, I think, unique in the history of economic thought. The idea being the recession, instead of being a terrible thing coming from sort of a God-given blight or something, in other words, some sort of like something like an earthquake or a plague, which has to be fought, the recession becomes not that, but the necessary medicine, which was the consequence of the real evil, which was the inflationary boom, which was created by the government itself. In other words, as the government and its banking system pumps in more credit into the economy, it not only raises prices, it also distorts production. It causes an overinvestment and all sorts of unsound investments and unsound machine tool and construction and so forth. And therefore, it becomes more and more necessary to have a recession in order to shift resources back into the healthy free market kind of economic system. It's necessary to liquidate these unsound investments as fast as possible. And if the government tries to eliminate the recession by prolonging the agony, in other words, by stopping this process in all sorts of ways, all it will do is prolong the agony and lengthen and make the depression chronic instead of acute. For example, in the last, what Benjamin Anderson, the late economist for the Chase Manhattan, Chase National Bank at the time, called the last free market recession, or last free market recovery, was 1921. It was a very severe post-World War I depression. Prices fell very rapidly. Unemployment went up very, very sharply. However, the depression, even though severe, since the government didn't interfere with it, didn't try to help out the unemployed by unemployment relief, didn't try to shore up unsound investments through government lending operations, didn't try to create deficits to cure it, didn't try to engage in public works programs and so forth. They didn't do anything. As a result, the depression was over very, very, very rapidly. As a matter of fact, by the time the government figured they should do something about the depression, it was all over. In 1929, when the Hoover administration came in, Hoover acted very, very quickly, unfortunately, and engaged in all the New Deal programs, which we associate with Franklin Roosevelt, which were really begun by Herbert Hoover. And the whole business, government loans, unsound investments, keeping wage rates up, keeping prices up, deficit spending, cheap credit, no panoply of New Deal measures, really begun by Hoover. Incidentally, recently, in a recent interview, Rex Tugwell, the famous Franklin Roosevelt advisor, admitted that Hoover started the whole thing, but he couldn't say it at the time. He couldn't admit it because it was a political fight. Well, the result of the New Deal program, the Hoover-Roosevelt New Deal was, and instead of the recession being over in approximately 9 or 12 months, as the 1921 recession was, it was over, it lingered for about 11 or 12 years until World War II got us out of it. So the Mises-Hayek approach then is, the sort of public policy that emerges from the Mises-Hayek position is virtually the direct opposite of the Keynesian policy. In other words, the Keynesian policy is, if there's a recession, you pump spending in or you pump money in. If there's an inflation, you take money out. The Austrian view is, if there's an inflation, first place, stop inflating, which means stop creating new money and credit through the government's controlled banking system. And if there's a recession, don't do anything about it and let it work itself out as quickly as possible. Now, obviously, this is the direct opposite of the Keynesian prescription. It's also pretty clear as to what seems to be which policy the government's going to adopt when any kind of a crisis emerges. We see, for example, every time there's a slight problem with liquidity, the cry goes up among businessmen, among bankers, etc. There's a liquidity crunch, and therefore government has to step in and create money to solve this liquidity crunch problem. Well, the liquidity crunch is precisely the Austrian retribution catching up with the inflationary boom. The government always exceeds the short-run pressure to ease the problem, thereby pumping more inflation. One of the differences about the 20s was, one of the reasons why most of the economists in the 1920s did not forecast a depression is because in those days prices did not go up. The general price level remained about constant. The official theory was, if the price level remains constant, there can't be any problem with inflation. The Austrian view, however, was that in a normal course of events, prices don't remain constant, they fall. And we can see this, in other words, if you allow a capitalist economy to proceed unhampered, productivity goes up, as new inventions, as mass production comes in, etc., prices will tend to fall. We see that, for example, with TV sets, which cost about $2,000 in 1948, a really crummy set, we could hardly see anything. For this present situation, where TV sets $100 or something, for a much better set, if we divide that by the price level, and, you know, in real terms, of course, the price of TV sets has fallen fantastically. Well, this sort of thing happens all over the economy in an unhampered system. During the 1920s, when you had an increase in productivity, and the tendency would have been for falling prices, the government and the banking system kept pumping new money into the system, thereby creating the whole boom-bust cycle, even though prices did not go up. And the Austrians, as I say, foresaw that. Well, what happened was, and Mises and Hayek had predicted the 29 Depression, so when the 29 Depression came, their prestige went up among economic circles. Also, fortunately for Anglo-American economics, Hayek at that point left the University of Vienna and came to London School of Economics. He started gathering around him the best minds among younger English economists. And so from 1931 approximately until 35, 36, most English economists adopted this Austrian position, adopted the view that the cause of the business cycle was bank credit expansion, created this distortion in production, the government should leave things alone, stop inflating, leave things alone, and so forth. Sir John Hicks, who won the Nobel Prize last year, was an early Hayek student, and Alvin Hansen, and so forth and so on, a whole group of people who later shifted. The Austrian theory was adopted precisely because it was the only one that had predicted and also could explain the Great Depression, and it began to be adopted also in the United States. Just at that point comes the so-called Keynesian Revolution. Lord Keynes wrote his book in 1936, and the whole gang flip-flopped. What happens is, and this is very often true in the history of thought, by the way, not just in economics, but social sciences generally, is it wasn't that the Keynesians refuted the Austrian theory. The Austrian theory was just forgotten. Nobody ever refuted it. They didn't even talk about it. It's just the fashion changes. It's something like ladies' hemlines, I guess. Fashion changes, and just deal with it. They just stop talking about the Austrian stuff, and they deal with a completely different set of items, and that was it. The Keynesian Revolution was facilitated by the fact that Lord Keynes was extremely popular in English elite circles, so to speak. That English professors all knew each other in those days. It was a very tightly knit group. He was a very charismatic personality, and so he swept the whole group with him. Also, the Keynesian, one of the significant things about the Keynesian theory was, for the first time in the history of economic thought, there have been many differences among economists before that. This was the first time that economists, sort of official economists, professors and writers, etc., actually advocated inflation and deficit spending. Before that, economists had almost unanimously advocated balanced budget, sound money, the gold standard, and so forth. And so, in other words, here we have the Keynesians advocating what governments would love to do anyway. Because before that, economists were sort of like the peck's bad boy or the doer pessimist in the group. You know, the governments would try to advocate all sorts of wild boondoggles and fancy schemes. The economists always say, no, it's not going to work. The economists are sort of the wet blanket, they're sort of the official wet blanket among intellectuals and statesmen and stuff. Well, here we have Keynesians who are not wet blankets. They were very exuberant about the idea of government inflation and deficit spending and so forth, and so their ideas were adopted with great enthusiasm by the official political establishment. Lord Keynes said when he was in his book, when he was answering criticisms, that in the long run his theories won't work. And one of his very famous statements was, well, who cares, because in the long run we're all dead. Well, the problem is, of course, that right now Keynes is dead and we're still alive. In other words, we're living in the Keynesian long run and we're suffering from it. If we're interested in then solving the problems created by the Keynesian long run, which we're now living in, we have to return, it seems to me, to the so-called Austrian approach. And what's happening is that as the Keynesian theory is becoming more and more discredited, younger professors and graduate students are more and more adopting and rediscovering the Austrian approach, which to those of us who are sort of veteran Austrians, this is really like a real phenomenon.
At any rate, what happens in the 1920s is a bog settles on American economics, namely institutionalism. I here apologize to Pete Betke if he's good. I consider institutionalists, frankly, as dumb German historical school types. Those German historical school people without any scholarship or background or anything, sort of a moronic version of the German. Essentially for saying there is no economic law, there is no economic theory, there's only institutions, we should study institutions. Dorfman, who was an institutionalist, tried to claim there are certain subtle differences between them and the German historical school. I can never really figure them out. I think there are distinctions without a difference. So what you have then in the 1920s, almost no theory going on. Institutionalists like Ely, John R. Commons, who was Ely's assistant at Wisconsin, was founder of the Wisconsin Idea, and Ely's interpreter and assistant, and postmillennial pietist, head of the vice chairman of the Institute for Christian Sociology, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the only guy actually studying institutions. Most institutionalists just gas around a lot and attack everybody else. They don't really do anything. I mean, Commons actually did a lot. He just studied legal property rights and American labor history, in which he was an excellent labor historian. So at least he did something, so I have to honor him for that. So, and of course, Thorstein Veblen, famous institutionalist and general pain in the neck. All I can say about that, I have no respect for Veblen whatsoever, I must say. All I can say about it is he kept pushing the distinction between production for profit and production for use, which we've already talked about. That the terrible thing about capitalism, it produces for profit, it should be producing for use, and he's in favor of the engineers taking over and running the society and producing for use. In other words, he knew no economics whatsoever, that's the only thing I could say about it. And What's that? Mencken called him a Marxist with dishwater, well water. In other words, a diluted Marxist. I guess Marx was too systematic for him. So another thing about Bentley, sort of a Galbraith who couldn't write very well. Another thing. Galbraith is really totally taken out of Veblen, except Galbraith is a good writer and Veblen wasn't. And Galbraith, of course, never acknowledges Veblen either. Bellyaching about it, conspicuous consumption and the affluent society, we're all too affluent, and all the rest of it. I don't think it's really worth discussing more than that. One interesting thing, the only interesting thing about Veblen, he didn't get along with the left liberals. Being extreme leftist, he only got along with right-wingers. Kind of an odd duck. I've seen that happen in other places. They passed on as a phenomenon. Eugene D. Genovese, a brilliant Marxist historian, probably the only scholarly Marxist historian around, has broken everybody on the left. The only person he talks to are right-wingers. So in the 1930s, in the United States, there was a vacuum in American economics. No theoretical, no theory at all, really. It's just sort of moping around talking about institutions, or somebody else should talk about institutions. And then, so bingo, when Keynes comes in, it sweeps the board. In other words, the path was open for a Keynesian revolution, because there was no real competing theory here. This brings me to the Keynes stuff. That Hayek, well, you all know this, Hayek was Mises' most famous and best student, got an appointment, the Austrian Academia, by the way, there's a great article out, just came out in Hope, History of Political Economy, a long article by Eileen Carver, the wife of Axel Landhoffer, about Austrian emigres in the United States, Austrian economists. Talks about all these people, Mises and all these people, great loving length. Austrian economics was tightening up. I mean, academic posts were and still are in Europe very scarce, and so they started emigrating to the United States. And Hayek emigrated to, got an offer of a post in London, London School of Economics. Lionel Robbins was a Misesian and brought the knowledge. He was a professor in London School, a young professor then, and brought Hayek over. He got a chair. And Hayek then hits the English system like a thunderbolt. They never heard of Austrian economics. Being Marshallians, they had no capital theory. They never applied anything to money and all the rest of it. So this whole thing hit. Hayek's lectures, Prices and Production, was originally a series of lectures, a great book by Hayek. Originally, lectures in London School. Monetary Theory and the Trade Cycle was originally in German and then translated quickly. So Robbins started sponsoring the translation of a whole bunch of stuff, several books by Hayek. And Hayek converts all the London School people like that. Almost everybody we now think of as Keynesians were originally Hayekians, Money and Business Cycles in particular. Abel Lerner, John Hicks, Nicholas Kaldor, all the top English economists, originally young Hayekians. And Keynes, of course, was a big shot intellectually. All the English intellectuals knew each other. In the United States, nobody knows anybody else, particularly. It's all very diffuse. But there it's all in London, Oxford, and Cambridge, a small, restricted area. And Keynes was a glittering big shot for a long time. First of all, he started out as a big shot mathematician, writing a bad book on theory of probability, a book hailed in its time. And was also a big intellectual and member of the Bloomsbury set, artistic set of Bloomsbury, friend of Virginia Woolf and all these people, and then became an advisor of the Treasury in World War I and fought against the Versailles Treaty. So he was very well known, one of Marshall's top students at Cambridge. Marshall being at Cambridge was the heart of the English economic establishment. Pigou and Keynes were his two top students. Of course, Keynes had to destroy Pigou in order to establish his dominance, which he did by help of Joan Robinson and other intellectual thugs of the time, went around and upset Pigou and Robertson and all these other people, disrupting classes and attacking them and so on. Keynes wrote this treatise on money. Keynes sort of waffled around it, but I think his best book was The Tract on Monetary Reform, in which he analyzed, I think, great insight. He analyzes hyperinflation and runaway inflation as the people taking back the resources from the government. In other words, the government's printing money all the time and grabbing resources from the public. And hyperinflation is a method by which the public speeds up prices ahead of the increase in the counterfeiting, so they can at least keep some resources. An interesting insight. Treatise on Money is supposed to be his big book on money, and Hayek destroyed it with one of the great demolition jobs in Economica, in the London School of Economics. By the way, Economica was a marvelous publication. It was in the early and mid-30s. It was published in London School and had a lot of Austrian stuff in it, Robbinsian stuff. Robbins, by the way, Essay on Nature and Significance of Economic Science, which was the big methodology book in English until Friedman's evil article on positivism. And Robbins, I know Kurzner, I have a disagreement with Kurzner on this. Kurzner thinks that Robbins was really modern positivism and not Mises. I think it's semi-Misesian. It's Mises diluted. And the first edition of Robbins' book was even more Misesian. The second edition, which is the one we know about, which is in the libraries, he cuts out reference to Mises and includes stuff about indifference curve, things like that, beginning to waffle. But basically, it's a Misesian, it's a watered-down Misesian book. And Robbins has a very good article, Critique of Marshall, and so forth, and he's doing a very good job on this whole thing. It translates the theory of money and credit at long last, 1935. Okay? And the first English translation, gets it translated. By the way, this is an interesting footnote on Keynes. Keynes reviewed the theory of money and credit in German when it came out. Keynes was the editor, top editor of the Economic Journal, which is the big Cambridge publication, and says, well, he said it's an interesting book, but there's nothing new in it. If anything you can say about theory of money and credit, that isn't it. He then writes in his memoirs later, well, he says he didn't really know German very well. He knew enough German to read stuff he already knew, but now he couldn't absorb any new ideas in German. That's okay, but how does he have a goal to review books in German? Okay. Hayek demolished the Treatise on Money in two long, great articles in Economica, much of which applies to the general theory, by the way, the attack on capital theory and so forth, the alleged capital theory and all the rest of it. Keynes then goes back to the drawing board, essentially acknowledges that he's been smashed, and writes his new work, The General Theory. When Keynes' General Theory came out, Keynes being a big shot, was reviewed by big shot, every journal review. Go back and read the scholarly reviews. They're all totally negative. Pigou attacked it, Weiner attacked it, Knight attacked it, all attacked it, all the big shots, including Alvin Hansen. The case of Alvin Hansen is interesting. Alvin Henry Hansen was a free market type. Professor at the University of Minnesota, wrote a semi-Austrian book called Business Cycle Theory about 1933. Not really Austrian, didn't really understand it, but pretty favorable. Also wrote a book called Economic Something in an Unbalanced World, or something like that, 1931, attacking the idea of public works to cure depression. Great free market right-wing work. General Theory came out, he attacked it, denounced it in the reviews. Well, I don't think there's any favorable review of it. 2 years later, it swept everybody. Everybody was converted to Keynesianism, including Hansen, who became the country's outstanding Keynesian. So what's what are the reasons for the fantastic, for the sweeping of the board? Samuelson's, I forget now whether this is Samuelson's Foundations when he writes this, in the introduction, he said, what a wonderful world it was to be in a world, to be young enough to read Keynes' General Theory when it came out, and to be under 30, because his mind was open to this great new revelation. So why was this super successful? I went to college and graduate school at a time just, well, Keynes' General Theory had just come. We were reading Keynes' General Theory. See, nobody reads the General Theory now because we read Keynesian interpretations of it. This is before the Keynesians came out with the equations. So we actually had to read this stuff in the real thing, General Theory. Totally incomprehensible work. I mean, Keynes was a good writer when he wanted to be, when he was clear-headed, like in the book on Reparation, Versailles Treaty, Economic Consequences of the Peace. It was a very clearly written book. When he was a muddled thinker, he became a muddled writer. So nobody could really understand. Also, he contradicted himself on every page. For example, he'd say, the key to my thought is that saving always equals investment. Always, always, always equal investment. A page later, he said, the key to my thought is saving always differs from investment. Right? Kind of muggy. Now, if you're sort of an average rational person, you say, this is garbage and toss it in the wastebasket, which is what the older economists did. So as a result, you have the younger people saying, ah, we're the only ones who can understand the master. It's sort of a cult situation. All those over 30 are locked in their own paradigm. Now we can understand the master. We got this in. And the fact that it's very obscure makes it even more challenging. You write 2 billion journal articles on it, interpreting what they really thought. So this is one of the intellectual reasons, plus the fact that Keynes was important in intellectual life in England. They all knew him. But the interesting thing is, why did the Hayekians shift over? And Misesians. In other words, every Hayekian in England except Hayek and Lachmann, partially, I think even Lachmann is really a Keynesian, everybody except Hayek became, by the end of the numbers, by the early 30s, everybody in London school, all the younger people in England were, economists were Hayekians, Misesian Hayekians. By the end of the 30s, they were all Keynesians, all shifted over, including almost, and all the Misesians shifted over, partially shifted over. So if you read these people, Machlup, for example, one of Machlup's, low point of Machlup's intellectual career is his book on the multiplier, the foreign trade multiplier, came out in the 40s. Straight Keynesian analysis. But the thing about these people, Machlup and Harberer and all these people who sold out to Keynesianism or shifted over, there's always a Misesian strain there. All the good stuff is Misesian. Everything else is Keynes. In other words, they're never quite pure Keynesians. They always had a slight drawback, holding back. Gerhard Tintner is a big econometrician. He's always slightly apologetic about what's true, that we have assumptions here which aren't really true, etc. He was a Mises student. So, and same way with Morgan Stern, whose critiques of GNP statistics and all that are fantastic within the framework, trailing clouds of Misesian glory, so to speak. The question is, so why do they all shift over? Now, in the case of Hansen, is fairly, I think, fairly clear, at least according to Wilfred King, an old duffer I met in the 40s, who was the originator of income statistics, unfortunately, in the United States, national income statistics, also a price stabilizationist. I think he referred to Fisher as young Irving. So Wilfred King was a free market person, laissez-faire person, except for money and stabilization. said, yes, yes, we had a lot of, he taught, I think, in Minnesota with Hansen. Yes, yes, Hansen was a very good young lad when he was in Minnesota. As soon as he went to Harvard, he changed. That's certainly part of the picture. According to Schumpeter, has a very good assiduous critique of Keynes and general theory. The reason for the big shift, in addition to the obscurantism and so forth, is the fact that that's what the government wanted. There was a whole intellectual, first of all, governments always want to incur deficits and spend more. That's the essence of government. They're always straining at the leash. And the only people with their finger in the dike, so to speak, holding us back and attacking have been economists. There's always economists who are saying, no, you shouldn't intervene, you shouldn't increase the budget, you shouldn't have deficits. It'll cause bad consequences later. And so all of a sudden you have economists who say, no, the great thing is to have deficits. The more deficits, the better. The more spending, the better. It's good. And the guys who say it's bad are really reactionary old fuddy-duddies. They're not into the new dispensation. And so, of course, the governments love Keynesianism, and the Keynesians love the government. And you have the marriage of intellectuals and government and the state. Keynesians then take their place in the planning structure. For example, I don't know if you know this, but there was a world, I remember a world where there was no Council of Economic Advisors. It was a magnificent world. They have no planning, no budgetary, no forecast, no rotten forecast in the next 5 years, all of which are dead wrong. No positions for economists and that sort of stuff. It was great. And then everybody became more or less Keynesian. Even Arthur Burns was my professor. Claimed he wasn't a Keynesian, but of course really was. And so it was all infighting within the Keynesian framework. When, by the way, I was around when the Keynesian equations first started coming out, Modigliani and all these people. My own view is that the current revisionist view is that Keynesians distorted Keynes. Keynes is really a great guy, and Keynesians are really the bad guys. I don't believe it. I think Keynes was a Keynesian, insofar as it was anything at all. In other words, the equation is the only thing that made sense out of the master, made sense out of these contradictions. And they made a certain sense. They're all wrong, but at least they're a coherent structure. Keynes conveniently died early enough so he can't be challenged whether he agrees with the Keynesian equations or not. Then there's also stories like Hayek said that just before Keynes died, he wrote to Hayek and said, the Keynesians are going too far and all that. I don't really credit that too much. I don't credit letters like that. I mean, it's sort of a pleasantry rather than anything else. So as far as I'm concerned, Keynes is a Keynesian until proven otherwise. And as I say, justified deficits, etc. The best refutation of Keynes, this is kind of a sad story, is by Henry Hazlitt, who wrote a magnificent book, which nobody has ever read, as far as I know, called The Failure of the New Economics, where what Hazlitt did was go page by page, going through the entire general theory, a mighty effort, and doing a Misesian critique, a hardcore Misesian critique, all the way, every step by step. Nobody paid attention to it, much less refute it. That was it, sunk without a trace. I guess for two reasons. One is Hazlitt did not have a faculty position, didn't have a PhD. Therefore, he was not an economist, quote-unquote. He was ruled out as a paradigm by the establishment. Secondly, of course, he was anti-Keynesian and Misesian, which is bad, also bad. It's a great book. It's very clearly written, which, of course, is a bite mark against it, too. And also, he doesn't deal with the neo-Keynesian equations. He deals with the actual general theory. And so I guess that's another bite mark. I don't see why he has to deal with the equations. He's got the whole thing there. And he also then followed up with a collection of criticisms of Keynes, of negative reviews called Critics of the New Economics. So at any rate, not having a scholarly union card and all that, his book was totally ignored. Hutt is another great case. Hutt was also a non-Keynesian. Hutt was an Edwin Cannon student in London School. And it's very close to Austrianism, the Cannon-Hutt position, the London position. And Robbins was a student of Cannon. It was very easy for him to become an Austrian. All these guys, they all shifted over. Robbins, Hicks, of course, the whole gang. To an amazing extent, they recanted. I mean, very few people actually publicly recant. As far as I know, the only people who really did are ex-communists, of course, publicly recant. and Hicks and Robbins. Robbins wrote an excellent book called The Great Depression, a Misesian analysis of the 1929 Depression in 1934. And later in his life, he attacked the book as being a bad book, a terrible book. Nobody should read it. This, of course, was a Misesian book after he became a Keynesian and became a lord. A government planner. Hicks' theory of wages was essentially Austrian, his first edition. He later repudiated it as being a terrible book and evil and Austrian and so forth and so on. In later life, and Hicks is an interesting guy, in later life, of course, he became a sort of semi-Austrian again. He appeared at Austrian conferences, looked benignly upon the situation, wrote a sort of friendly story about Hayek as Austrianism became reviving. In other words, Hicks is essentially the person with his finger always to the wind, trying to figure out what the next trend is and hopping it. So when Austrianism was in vogue, he was an Austrian. When Keynesianism was in vogue, he was a Keynesian. And when Austrian is coming back again, he becomes an Austrian again, in a very cautious way, of course. So I think the reason for the shift over, these people knew better. I mean, actually, these people, Misesian Hayekians, knew about Keynes, knew the fallacies, and couldn't have been swept away in that young ecstasy like Samuelson. The only explanation I can tell is sellout. the only explanation I've got for this, and usually it's a fairly good explanation. One of my favorite phrases from that is a famous phrase in the Woodward Bernstein book and movie on Watergate. If you remember, when Woodward can't figure out what's going on, he's all totally lost, all his leads are gone, he goes to the Deep Throat, and he says, "Deep Throat, I'm lost, I have to stop the investigation, tell me what to do, Deep Throat," and he says, "Follow the money." And of course, then this revives the thing, and that's it. So I think, looking at the money factor, or the economic factor, I think is important here. Self-interest. In other words, the guys who left the Misesian Hayekian camp and became semi-Keynesians or Keynesians got posts at Harvard, Princeton, etc., and the others didn't. I'm not going to go into critique of Keynesianism. I haven't got the time. Also, it's a pretty daffy theory, filled with fallacies and riddled with it and so forth and so on. My favorite critique is the multiplier, and maybe you read it, quote myself here. I can demonstrate on Keynesian grounds that if you give me $1,000, it would be a huge, like a 2 million multiplier, and the whole national income will go up by about $2 trillion. And the magic multiplier. What we have, as I said, there's been an Austrian revival since about 74. I think actually in 73 we had the first Austrian conference ever since old Austria, the first United States Austrian conference with young Austrians in it. In 74, Hayek got the Nobel Prize, and it was an interesting thing. When he got the Nobel Prize, all the economists said, "Who the hell is Hayek? Who's this guy who got the Nobel Prize?" Which is the aim of every economist, right? Objective. And who is he? So they had to go back and find out what he was, at least, even for sociological purposes. And this created a Hayek boom, which is still on. One of my pet peeves, I wrote this in an article in Quarterly Journal of Economics many years ago, is that government functions by statistics. If you cut the statistics out, government can't function at all. I mean, they can't plan, can't even pretend to plan. They won't know what's going on. In other words, the market provides information to entrepreneurs, businessmen, or whatever, through the price system, etc. So businessmen don't really need much statistics. What they need is the statistics they themselves generate and knowledge about, qualitative knowledge of the market. The whole overall statistics, all the stuff that's launched from the Department of Commerce, Department of Labor, etc., is all for government information, basically. In other words, the government, for bureaucrats and politicians to do anything, they have to have statistics. They don't have any real-world knowledge except the statistics. Therefore, if we cut the statistics off, they're helpless. They can't do anything. So as a laissez-faire person, I've been advocating for many years eliminating all appropriations for government statistics. And statistics in general has been in service of the state. In other words, statistics, the first statisticians in economics were German historical school people who realized you had to use it to plan. The government has to use it to plan. And 19th century statisticians, that was their aim. We have to gather statistics so the government can plan things. They have to know how much unemployment there is so the government can cure it, and et cetera, et cetera. Richard T. Ely, my old buddy, who you already mentioned, the government is God's major instrument of redemption, of course, is a big empiricist statistician type. I mean, he himself did not gather statistics in favor of it. He said, "We need empirical data to, quote, mold the forces of work in society and to improve existing conditions." Samuel Ruggles, who was the American delegate to the International Statistical Congress in Berlin in 1863, said that, quote, "Statistics are the very eyes of the statesman, enabling him to survey and scan with clear and comprehensive vision the whole structure and economy of the body politic." It's true, of course, the converse of it, if you strip the government of statistics, they can't do anything. They can't even pretend to know anything, which is great. Carol Wright, who was one of the first commissioners of labor in the United States, who was a big statistician, was a student of Ernst Engel, the German historical school member, the head of the Royal Statistical Bureau of Prussia, and the founder of Engel's Law, and whatever that is, of consumption. Okay. Richard Ely was a former student of Engel. Henry Carter Adams was also a progressive economist along with Ely and established the Statistical Bureau of the Interstate Commerce Commission to carry on Engel's great work, believing, quote, that ever-increasing statistical activity by the government was essential for the sake of controlling nationally monopolistic industries. And Irving Fisher, whose life is dedicated to stabilizing the price level through manipulation of money and the Federal Reserve, wrote his work on the making of index numbers to try to show there was a scientific index number, the solution to index number problem, which of course there isn't. There ain't no scientific index number. There's no such thing as a scientific index number of the cost of living, for example, because everybody's got a different buying pattern. In other words, I buy a lot of books. The cost of living index, which pinpoints the classic Dayton, Ohio housewife with two kids and the wife of a steel worker, they don't buy any books, so maybe the Reader's Digest summary or something. So the book prices, which have been skyrocketing, as you all know, that never gets in the inflation index. My inflation index is very different from the Dayton, Ohio housewife index, right? And that's not, of course, that's stamped out. As Fisher said in the book Making of Index Numbers, until this difficulty could be met, stabilization could scarcely be expected to become a reality. You can't stabilize the price level if you don't know what the price level is. Deprive them of that, boy. We have them. Now, all these people, Carol Wright was a Bostonian, a progressive reformer. Henry Carter Adams was the son of a New England Pietist congregational preacher on missionary duty in Iowa, who started out to study for the ministry at his father's alma mater, Andover Theological Seminary. Irving Fisher. Okay, we get to Irving Fisher, one of my pet peeves here, the alleged greatest economist of the 20th century. He was the son of a Rhode Island Congregationalist Pietist preacher. Watch out for sons of preachers, I guess. His parents were both of old Yankee stock. His mother a strict Sabbatarian. He was an inveterate reformer of a crusading spirit. He was an unbelievable prohibitionist. As a matter of fact, he wrote three books during the 1920s saying that prohibition works, proving by statistics that prohibition was good. He also believed in the outlawry. You know, get this, he was particularly enthusiastic about purging the world, quote, of such iniquities of civilization as alcohol, tea, coffee, tobacco, refined sugar, and bleached white flour, all of which he wanted to outlaw. He was an early health nut. For those of us in the anti-health nut movement. And, of course, he loved Benjamin Strong because he was stabilizing the price level. Then we have Wesley Clair Mitchell, institutionalist, founder of the National Bureau of Economic Research, and beloved figure, student of Thorstein Veblen, and who also was dedicating himself. He wanted a lot of government statistics, such as in World War I, to be able to plan the system. All these guys, by the way, love World War I. They all took their spots in the collectivist planning system. As Dorfman, who was a friend and student of Mitchell, put it about Mitchell, that he was clearly the type of social scientist, paraphrasing something on Mitchell, saying that clearly the type of social invention most needed today is one that offers definite techniques through which the social system can be controlled and operated to the optimum advantage of its members. That's Mitchell. And Dorfman says, to this end, Mitchell constantly sought to extend, improve, and refine the gathering and compilation of data. Mitchell believed that business cycle analysis might indicate the means to the achievement of orderly social control of business activity. I mean, see, now all this time, Mitchell was claiming to be value-free scientist. Just a value-free scientist, a gathering statistics in order to do what? In order to be able to plan the system. That's allegedly value-free. Mitchell's wife and collaborator, Lucy Mitchell, in her memoirs, talking about herself and her husband, said that Mitchell envisages the great contribution the government can make to the understanding of economic and social problems if the statistical data gathered independently by various federal agencies were systematized and planned so the interrelationships among them could be studied. The idea of developing social statistics, not merely as a record but as a basis for planning, emerged early in his own work. So he joins World War Collectivism in World War I. At the end of World War I, an interesting event happened, namely, the American Economic, just this is December 1918, 1 month after the armistice, the American Economic Association and the American Statistical Association had a joint meeting. I don't think they've ever done that before or since. A joint conclave in Richmond, Virginia, fairly close to Washington, where they had all been percolating during the war. And they have a joint meeting with presidential speeches by Fisher to the American Economic Association and Mitchell to the American Statistical Association. And they were very optimistic. They loved the war, and they loved the post-war world, which they figured would be an extension of the war, which, of course, in a sense, it was. Fisher looks forward to an economic world reconstruction that would provide glorious opportunities for economists to satisfy their constructive impulses. I mean, plan the world, right? A class struggle, Fisher noted, would surely be continuing over distribution of the nation's wealth. But by devising a mechanism of what he called readjustment, the nation's economists could occupy an enviable role as the independent and impartial arbiters of the class struggle, these disinterested social scientists making the crucial decisions for the public good. In other words, this is the role of the intellectuals, and Fisher and Mitchell saw themselves, and all these other guys did too. Everybody else is involved in, they're all class, bound by their own class interests, all selfish and narrow and so forth and so on, businessmen, unions, etc., etc. We, the intellectuals, the planners, levitate above us the class struggle. We believe only in the truth, and therefore we are the ones who are divinely appointed or whatever to plan everything for everybody else, to decide, make all of these decisions on the basis of the national interest and the common good. In those days, they all said that openly. See, nowadays, it's much more... This is before the science of public relations had been advanced to a high art. Everybody's pretty out front with their position. That's why it's interesting to study this whole period. You know, the engineers would say, we are engineers, the society is complex, and thus, therefore, we should plan the whole world. You know, the engineers and economists should plan the whole world. Of course, little squabble there, but who should be the top planners? The most interesting guy is Charles Steinmetz, the great inventor, General Electric's main inventor, General Electric being a Morgan firm, by the way. So Steinmetz called himself a socialist. He wanted world socialism. Right? And his view was that the World Socialist should be planned and run by the corporations, obviously made mostly General Electric, and that the top inspiration and guide for the World Corporation should be the world great world inventors, obviously, namely himself. In other words, his view was of a General Electric world with him running it. This is the idea of socialism. I guess it was socialism, different form. And Mitchell proclaimed that the war led to the use of statistics, as the president of the American Statistical Association, not only as a record of what happened, but it also as a vital factor in planning what should be done, same thing as Lucy Mitchell said. He also said that war had shown that when the community desires to attain a great goal, within a short period, far-reaching social changes can be achieved. The need for scientific planning of social change, he added, has never been greater. The chance of making those changes in an intelligent fashion has never been so good. The peace, he said, will bring new problems, but it seems impossible that the various countries will, quote, will attempt to solve them without using the same sort of centralized directing now employed to kill their enemies abroad for the new purpose of reconstructing their own life at home. This is a constant theme from then on, for the rest of the century, the New Deal period, and World War II. We did such a wonderful job in World War I, planning everything, running everything, cartelizing everything. Why can't we do that for peace as well as war? Why can't we use these great means of collectivism for peaceful purposes? Then he says, in contrast to the quantitative physical sciences, he tells the statisticians at Mitchell, that the social sciences are still immature, speculative, and filled with controversy and class struggle. But quantitative knowledge, in other words, statistics, could replace such struggle and conflict by commonly accepted precise knowledge, objective knowledge, amenable to mathematical formulation, and capable of forecasting group phenomena. A statistician, Mitchell opined, that, quote, is either right or wrong, and it's easy to demonstrate which. As a result of precise knowledge of facts, Mitchell envisioned, we can achieve, quote, intelligent experimenting and detailed planning rather than agitation and class struggle, unquote. And then he said, to achieve these vital goals, economists and statisticians would provide, of course, the crucial element, for we would have to be, quote, relying more and more on trained people to plan changes for us, to follow them up, to suggest alterations, unquote, namely, of course, himself and his buddies. So what you have is a naked grab for power. By the way, the Marxists call Mannheim, German Marxist, was presented with a problem. If everybody is determined by the class interest, what about intellectuals? What about Marx, who was obviously a bourgeois type and so forth? What about where do they fit in? His answer was that intellectuals are free float. They levitate above the class struggle. So everybody else is determined, but we're free. This is, by the way, the typical determinist argument. All you guys are determined, but I've somehow broken through this. I have free will. There's some good material on all this. There's two left-wing books, one by Guy Alcon, Princeton University Press. I think it's called The Invisible Hand of Planning. It's about the 1920s, and all these social scientists have a grab for power. And he quotes Mitchell and Fisher and so forth. Of course, he's saying, he's attacking the centrists for selling out Marxism-Leninism or whatever. It really doesn't matter what position of the author is, as long as he gets the right stuff. James Gilbert had a book called Designing the Industrial State, came out about 20 years ago, about what he called collectivist intellectuals of the progressive era in World War I. He's the one that talks about Steinmetz and General Electric socialism. David Noble has a book, America by Design, which is in paperback, about scientists and the nationalization of science in World War I, how the scientists all grabbed for power and industry. He said, boy, World War I is great because we have government direction of science. We can channel science and research into different areas, which, of course, more funds than you get outside it. Designing the Industrial State. There's a lot of good stuff on this, which is, of course, neglected by mainstream historians, to say the least. Yeah. Anyway, there's a lot of stuff to be done, a lot of research. This is really sort of tapping the surface of it. There's I can refer to other, but I think, Manny wanted me to mention some overall references to the history of thought, economic thought. There's no really good book on history of economic thought extant, which is why I'm writing one. The most inclusive book is by Henry W. Spiegel, called The Growth of Economic Thought, something like that. The titles are all very similar. And that's it's available in paperback, and it's huge, like 900 pages. And it's got everything in it, because he's wrong about almost everything. But I mean, at least he's got the facts. Development of Economic Thought or Growth of Economic Thought, something like that. It's published by Prentice Hall, so it's widely available. He's got a very good annotated bibliography, about 150 pages, which is very comprehensive and quite the best part of the book. And as I say, he's got all these people in there, he's got all the groups. The really best book is Alexander Gray, but it's very short. Came out in 1931. It's called The Development of Economic Thought. The growth is the same, similar title. And what he does, he only covers a few groups. He covers Smith, Ricardo, Marx, etc. He winds up with the Austrians, interesting enough. You know, he wrote in 1931, ignores everybody, ignores Marshall and all the other stuff. Goes right to the heart. He's also a great writer, one of the great writers in economic thought. Witty, sardonic, and all the rest of it, perceptive. Demolishes people with two sentences, things like that. He also wrote a book called The Socialist Tradition on Socialism. great on that. He says one quip about one of these crazy socialist books, one of these 10-volume books or something like that, impossibly written, he says, is the sort of book, he said, you give as one of the 6 books that Hitler should gonna take to the desert island. Unfortunately, now, Gray is a second edition, but some guy named Thompson writing stuff for my Keynes, which is worthless. So that's supposed to be in print, the Gray Thompson book, but I understand now it's not in print. It's out of stock for 3 months. So this is where we stand. You can get the older edition, and you can get the newer edition, but they're both out of stock, but they're sometimes in stock. After that, it's sort of a swamp. I mean, the Schumpeter book is a great book, but it's very obscure, and it's also eccentric, in the sense that Schumpeter is great on some things and bad on other stuff, and you can't predict which it's going to be at any moment. Schumpeter is a very interesting economist. I didn't have the time to go into his doctrine. It's the only business cycle theory worth talking about, aside from Mises Hayek, I think. And I think it's wrong, but it's very interesting. It's derived from a Walrasian. In fact, he was a Walrasian. Unfortunately, he was a bum Bavarian and then shifted to Walras. Although he has the great, probably the best tribute to another economist in the world ever written was Schumpeter's obituary, memorial article to Bombardier. It's magnificent. Part of his 10 great economists, I think. So I say that I think it's a very interesting endeavor, an interesting writer, but basically wrong and stuff. His original business cycle theory was so obviously wrong that he had to create new epicycles in his 2-volume work on business cycles. He said there were several business cycles all going on at once and then accumulating. He, unfortunately, was responsible for bringing the Kondratiev wave into American thought, of which it has still not yet been purged. But he's an interesting writer, but he didn't finish this book. He's unfair to some people, and I can't really recommend it as a key book, as an overview. There's not too much else. Scott has a pretty good book. It's very old. There are certain specific things of specific writers, of course, but as an overall situation, that's about it. Unfortunately, Ekelund and Hebert's textbook is extremely Whiggish. In other words, the sort of thing where everybody is great. Austrians are great. Keynesians are great. They're all, all contribute to the world outlook, so for an Austrian, it's, of course, kind of lovable because here I'm cited in Ekelund and Hebert favorably, but everybody else is cited favorably, too. and the thing is, I think, that since Austrian economics is true, there's a certain desire for truth on the part of people. There's a truth value for people. For scholars, it's supposed to be even more of a truth value of truth. It doesn't always work, but in some cases it does. And so you have this shining truth coming up as being combated by other influence. I think the truth, the shining truth, is also what then begins to happen is eventually faulty theories begin to collapse. So what happens is that for various reasons, theories begin to collapse. Take Keynesianism, for example, which was dominant for many years. And the government loved it, and they loved it, and everything's great. Keynesianism began to decline on the theoretical level when the equations were worked out. When Modigliani's equation was worked out in Econometrica, I think in 48, 50, they found out the whole thing rests on the assumption of wage rates being rigid downward. Okay? Otherwise, nothing works. But it's not supposed to be that. It's supposed to be all blamed on capitalism. Now we find out the rigid wage rates now, it has to be blamed either government or unions. Okay, so the whole political focus begins to shift. Then other things begin to pop up. The magic multiplier gets reduced to about 1 by the Keynesian statisticians. That's the magic evaporates. And gradually, on the theoretical level, Keynesian begins to lose out. Not replaced by anything particularly good, but at least the Keynesian paradigm is losing out. And then, when the Keynesian political predictions flopped, okay, in other words, I mean, Keynesianism rests basically on the idea that you have a recession or you have an inflation. In the recession, you pump money in, you pump spending in, or whatever proportion you're going to do it. When you have an inflation, you take money out or you take spending out. What do you do, however, when you have inflation and recession at the same time? As Rand would say, blank out. There's no answer. And this, of course, began to appear after World War II, especially in 1973. Recession, we have a galloping inflation along with a recession. Then they had to bug out. And they had it. And with Keynesianism as an intellectual force, stopped. Doesn't mean the Keynesians stopped. Or as the Marxists would say, the ruling class, in this case, had lost their will to rule. I mean, they didn't know what the hell to do. Do you inflate? Do you deflate? What do you do? And so they sort of hung in there, trying everything, and putting your foot ultimately on the accelerator, on the brake, trying to hope that something works. And basically, that's what the Keynesians have been in ever since. And that's why the Friedmanites won out. The Friedmanites not won out because of high theory. They won out because Keynesianism was dead, basically. And so people said, hey, maybe the money supply is important. Maybe these jerks out there in Chicago are right. Friedmanism was tried. Okay, so that's a reality check on faulty theory. Eventually, it begins to come a cropper, both on theoretical grounds and on practical policy grounds, and then it begins to collapse. So there's still Keynesians around it, but really have nothing to say particularly. Sort of, spinning wheels. And what interesting enough will happen on the monetarists politically in the Reagan administration. When the Reagan administration first came in, there were 4 contending economic groups. There were the old-fashioned conservatives, of which libertarians were sort of like extreme variant. Of course, lost out within a year, all kicked out or left. like Martin Anderson, people like that. They were out. Those were in favor of a low budget, big budget cuts, big tax cuts, not inflating. They were out very fast. Then, so you have the monetarists as the supply side and right-wing Keynesians contending for power. So the monetarists were big at the beginning. Like Sprinkle becomes shooting his mouth off, another Secretary of the Treasury. They were in charge of the money supply. That was what the Reagan administration, what they did was, they put the Keynesians in charge of the budget, because they're interested in the budget. They put the monetarists in charge of the money supply. So each one gets his own turf. So the monetarists were running the Fed for a couple of years, even though Friedman kept saying, it's not really monetarist, it's all baloney. I mean, you have 2% off for one-tenth of one. It was a monetarist policy for about several years. Total flopperoo in monetarist own terms, since Friedman says the science is prediction. The whole point of science is prediction. They kept making predictions, they kept flopping. I mean, outrageous flops. So if you live by the sword, by the prediction sword, you're going to die by the prediction sword. And when the prediction comes a cropper, you've had it. The monetarists were discredited. A whole bunch of faulty predictions, including a prediction that you could tamper inflation slowly, turn down inflation without having a recession, which, of course, any Austrian could have told them was impossible. And that was it. These few predictions, as a result, monetarism is now politically discredited, not so much in the economics profession, but in politics. As a result, Sprinkle has been relegated to the Council of Economic Advisers, which is now Siberia. No influence, no power, no nothing. He's kept his mouth shut. And now what's happened is the supply side, who are really Keynesians anyway, become Keynesians. They're all sort of a lovely stew pot coalition of supply-sider Keynesians and conservative Keynesians. By the way, it's another thing. Supply-siders are people who now take up the torch of Abel Lerner, saying there's no problem with public debt. Who cares about a deficit? They don't quite say we owe it to ourselves. That's the next step. By the way, on supply-side, I would recommend everybody read, to understand supply-side doctrine, Jude Winiski's famous book, The Way the World Works, which came out just before the Reagan election, 1980-79. Think about the Winiski book, which was a bestseller, but I can't find anybody who's ever read it. Winiski book is very interesting. It's fascinating because he has a whole philosophy of history at work. Philosophy of history is basically this. He's what we can call very kindly a right-wing Hegelian. He says, history is the working out of the will of the masses. The will of the masses is correct. It's always correct. The masses know the truth. So the function of the intellectual and the politician is not to enlighten the masses, because the masses know everything anyway. The masses are always right. It's to embody the correct will of the masses into institutions, into history. History is a providential onward and upward march by which the masses' correct will is involved and embodied in history. So he has got the two ends in life for Winiski, the two goals of history are one, world government, and two, world pure democracy, because democracy is the more democratic the better, because the masses can express their will faster. I swear it's in there. As a matter of fact, he's the only person who's written in the last 50 years who loves World War I. Usually, you know, the famous story of the right-wingers love the Cold War and liberals love World War II. He loves World War I. Why World War I? The most destructive war, but pointless war, because it got rid of the kings. He considers the kings absolute evil because they're not democratic. He says that Hitler and Stalin, despite their various defects, were better than the kings, or they were at least democratic. They came in with, I swear it's in there. I had to review the book for somebody, so I had to read the damn thing. I'm not considered a scholarly contribution, in the least. Okay, thank you very much.